I love that Ostara story that I told you earlier. It is my favorite story. I took a storytelling class in seminary, and I did the entire thing around that story because it's just so beautiful. I love the persistent child and the exhausted goddess. I can relate. I love the creative thinking, the surprise at the end. I love the fact that we learn that the Easter Bunny is a she. Eggs, friends. I love that the idea that rebirth can happen in an unexpected way, and that we can return to our old selves sometimes, even if only for a moment. But I don't believe that story actually happened. It's a story, and stories can still be powerful things. The author, Jonathan Gottschall, wrote an excellent book. I highly recommend it. It's called The Storytelling Animal. He argues that the unique characteristics is not our language or our tool making, but it is that we tell stories. That we essentially sit around and lie to each other. Lies, insofar as that they aren't always true, rather than, say, doing more evolutionarily advantageous things like hunting or gathering. Why do we do this? His book suggests many reasons, not least of which is that stories provide a place for us to practice our feelings, as Rachel said. To experience danger, worry, fear, confusion, and elation in a safe way. Today, a particular story is being told around the world in Christian communities of every stripe and every color. We here at the Fellowship are not a Christian community, but we are inspired by Jewish and Christian teachings as one of our six sources of UU inspiration. And our tradition's heritage is of the liberal wing of the Christian church. We were often the heretics, going against the grain of mainstream teachings for centuries, and in some ways we still are. So this story today deserves our attention. Even if we don't all believe it to be true. Some of us might. That's the joy and beauty of a faith like ours. We have freedom of belief. But just like the story of Ostara, we can still find meaning if we allow ourselves to read it anew. Unsullied, if possible, by all the history and drama around it. If we can just read it as it is. Now, I realize that that's hard, but I just challenge us this morning to try to let go of all the things you think you know about this story, the things you have been told, and to try to hear it as if it was for the first time. According to the earliest gospel, which is attributed to Mark, it was written about 40 years after the crucifixion. And so clearly, this was not an eyewitness account. But here's how the story goes, starting with chapter 15, verse 40, right after the death of Jesus. Some women were watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, the younger, and of Joseph and Salome. In Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Many of the other women had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after the sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, "Who will roll away the stone from the entrance of the tomb?" When they look up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him? But go, tell the disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb, and they said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. So what does this story tell us? I don't know about you, but the first thing I notice is the women. The women were there. They didn't run away. They stayed. They watched. And then after Jesus was laid in his tomb, they were the ones who were going to go take care of business. They were going to prepare Jesus' body for burial, and they weren't even sure how they were going to roll that heavy rock away from the tomb. Now, if you think about the things you've been told about this story, is that it? Not me. But those women give me courage. The story also tells me that by 40 years after Jesus' birth, death, the story of his resurrection was being clearly told. By the time this story is written, people are telling the story of his resurrection. He is risen. He is not here. Now, Mark is known by most biblical scholars to be probably the earliest of the four Gospels, and also was probably used as a source for the writers of both Matthew and Luke. They probably had Mark in front of them when they were writing Matthew and Luke. So Mark is probably the most accurate, if we're going to go there. By the time Mark is written, the crucifixion and resurrection are being shared in storytelling. But the earliest versions of this gospel end there. The women were afraid and they told no one. The end. No Jesus sightings, no pierced hands, no great commission. But clearly they did tell someone, or else the story wouldn't have gotten very far. It goes on in later manuscripts like this. So if you have a Bible at home, this is what it looks like. When Jesus rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had driven seven demons. She went and she told those who had been with him and who were mourning and weeping. And when they heard that Jesus was alive and that she had seen him, they did not believe it. Afterward, Jesus appeared in a different form to two of them while they were walking in the country. These returned and reported it to the rest, but they did not believe them either. Later, Jesus appeared to the 11 as they were eating. He rebuked them for their lack of faith and for their stubborn refusal to believe those who had seen him after he had risen. After the Lord Jesus had spoken to them, he was taken up into heaven and he sat at the right hand of God. And then the disciples went out and they preached everywhere. And the Lord worked with them and confirmed his word by the signs that accompanied it. So what does this story tell us? It tells me that they didn't believe the women. Shocking, I know. The women said stuff and then they didn't believe them? What? None of us have had that experience. In the era of hashtag me too, the Bible is actually pretty clear. Jesus rebuked them for their stubborn refusal to believe those who had seen him after he had risen. This is why I love rereading the story with new eyes. Because if I allow the centuries of debris, the resurrection, the miracle, the other stuff to get in the way, I might miss what this story really says. The women were there, and they weren't believed. So this comic, Adam, could you put this comic up? This comic I saw the other day sums it up pretty well. It was shared online with the caption, "Easter Monday, feast day of the mansplaining of the resurrection." The comic reads, "So ladies, thanks for being the first to witness and report the resurrection. We'll take it from here." So good. So, the other stuff is awesome, don't get me wrong. I mean, all of that other stuff that accompanies the story is very cool too, I guess. But the story gives us even more than we can work with. And I am someone who gets very frustrated in our culture when the Bible is used to defend hateful things. And it's easy for me to say, well, okay, that's fine. I don't believe any of that. You can do that. But you know what's even more effective? Is to say, you know, the Bible also says this. So I encourage us to be literate enough in these stories so that we can do that in conversation with people in our culture. That we don't just hand the Bible over to people who are going to use it for harm. So what does any of this have to do with that dancing guy? According to the story, Jesus gets all the credit as the leader. He's the one that everyone is following. It's his name that gets remembered. But really, if you think about it, Jesus was just the lone nut. He was the shirtless dancing guy until others chose to follow him. The video tells us that there are some important skills necessary to be a good leader. You need to be easy to follow, and I'm not sure that was actually true of Jesus. He was saying some very radical things that people did not want to hear. The video also says that you need to embrace your followers, and he did do that. Whatever it was that Jesus was teaching, easy or not, it was attracting followers, people who believed he had something important to say. And until he gathered those followers, no one was going to listen to him or take him seriously. He was only considered a threat when he had crowds following him. Jesus' message could have died with him. Even if he did resurrect, according to the story, he didn't stick around for very long. He went back to heaven. And so the fact that 40 years after he left this earth, and much, much later, people are telling this story, that is a testament less to Jesus, in my head, and more to the followers who kept him alive. So what does it mean to exercise followership as a primary form of leadership? Our own mission statement here at the Fellowship says a few things. It says we welcome everyone, that we grow in mind and spirit, and that we lead in social justice. Lead. And I would argue that we could do more as leaders if we did more as followers. That we could do more as leaders if we did more as followers. And so I want to take one example of social justice in our wider community that we are working for, our undocumented neighbors who have banded together and they are advocating for their rights, their safety, improved legislation. They are, by definition, marginalized, this group of people. They are pushed aside by the powers that be, the government, the decision makers, the media. Their voices are crying out in the wilderness. They have a message worthy of following, but their leadership isn't being heeded, at least not by many. Right now, they are Jesus before his baptism. They're the dancing guy in the field at the music festival. But what did the video say? It said, never underestimate the power of the first followers. It's the first followers that give others the courage to join. The first followers that make the dancing guy a leader instead of a lone weirdo. If we want to take our leadership seriously, and I believe that we do, then we need to truly take the risk of being among the first followers. To be visible and vocal and clearly following the leadership of others, in this case, our immigrant neighbors. If we mean what we say by our sanctuary status, then we need to be following their lead, asking what they need. We need to be carrying their stories, amplifying their voices farther than they would be able to alone. Places where our privilege allows their message to be heard. And now if we did this, even more than we are doing today, we are doing some, but if we fully, intentionally, visibly committed to followership of this group of people, then we might provide the courage for others who want to join, but maybe don't yet know how, or who are afraid of what others might think. But if we are among the first followers, we take the heat. And soon more come, and the leader becomes the leader that they always were, but now they have a crowd paying attention. But there's also a risk. We saw this with the dancing guy, and we saw it with Jesus and his message. If followers join, more might come too. At a certain point, it's easy for the leader's message to be diluted or even polluted. Now, the dancing guy, he started off like this, remember? Kind of chill and cool. And and within 90 seconds, the crowd grew so large and chaotic that the dance became really high energy and wild. It was no longer the dance of the leader, it was the dance of the crowd. They had made it their own. 2,000 years after Jesus' message was last spoken on this earth, the leader has so many followers that it is impossible to count them all, and they have made his message their own. I don't blame the leader for that. I don't blame the first followers. I blame the impact of time and space and power. It's not Jesus' fault that his followers have warped his message of love and peace and inclusion. Even Paul, who became the most powerful apostle of them all, Paul never met Jesus, and even he strayed pretty far from the teachings of Jesus in those gospels. And then he got put in the Bible, and then everyone follows him. One of the most important roles of the first follower is not to just attract more followers, but to keep them on track. To remind them that they are making the movement about themselves and that we're not supposed to be doing that, to point back again and again and again to the leaders, so that this means that we need to follow and to course correct again and again, to check our privilege, to remember that we're doing the best leadership by following, to remind other followers to do the same. Easter is a powerful story. It's one among many powerful stories, to be sure, of the triumph of life over death, hope over despair. It's a powerful story of the incredible message of one man and the women who shared his story, and somehow the story lived on. It got interpreted and reinterpreted and warped over time. But when we go back to the story as it is told, it never ceases to amaze me that it lived. If nothing else, it lives and it continues to provide the hope of life, wholeness, and emergence from despair to so many throughout the world. Like the story that the earth tells us this time of year and the story of a bird saved by a goddess, may we too strive to bring hope, wholeness, and love to the world through our leading and our following. May it be so. Amen.